I woke up this morning and thought I had been transported to London. The fog was extraordinary. And I was reminded of the greatest description of fog in all of English literature, which comes at the opening of Charles Dickens' great novel, Bleak House. Not to add more reading to your list, but it's a very great novel about the law courts and modern lawyers. It's an extraordinary book. But if you don't have time to read the whole book, if you see the book sometime, or even if you're in a bookstore, read the first couple of pages, which is the description of London absolutely trapped by fog, where nothing can be seen. There are no guideposts, no direction, and the fog just keeps rolling in. It's a wonderful passage. So I'm beginning the discussion with Shakespeare this morning with a little tip of the hat to Mr. Dickens. I'm sure neither one of them would mind. I'll begin with a little apology. That is, we're going to spend a few days on Hamlet, and that's not enough. Whenever I teach it, I end up devoting more and more time to it, and I never get very far with it. I mentioned yesterday, every actor who attempts the role ends up feeling inadequate, that somehow he's failed. The famous story of Olivier being asked any roles he didn't get to do, and saying, well, no, I got to do them all, but I wish I could have one more go at Hamlet, having done it 5 times on stage and still feeling he didn't quite get it right, and maybe with a 6th go at it he would. When I was an undergraduate, a very renowned professor gave a seminar in Hamlet. I wasn't able to get into it. I didn't take it, but I had a friend in it. And at the end of the semester, they'd made it into Act 2, Scene 1. After spending the entire semester looking at the play, they never got much beyond the first act. That can happen. It is in the nature of the play. The title character himself has some sense of that. You'll remember the moment. It's nicely done by Mel Gibson in the film, where he is playing with the pipe and asking Rosencrantz and Guildenstern to play on the pipe. And they say, well, we don't know how. And he says, but you would play upon me. And then the famous line, you would pluck out the heart of my mystery. Well, no one's done it yet. So let me begin our discussion of Hamlet with this quotation by a fairly sensible critic named Harry Levin, who said, Hamlet is the most problematic play ever written by Shakespeare, or any other playwright, unquote. Hamlet is just a whole bundle of problems and questions. Now, we don't have to admit defeat in the face of it. There are certain things that we can learn. There are certain things that we can know about it. And I think particularly, given our fortunate background as Catholics in a time of trouble, there's much we can understand about this play that the rest of the world misses. I'm not going to go through a whole life of Shakespeare. I've done it elsewhere. But there are a couple of points I want to make about this play before we head into it. And I would like to begin with just a few words about Shakespeare, but particularly, because I think it's very important here, the background of Shakespeare as a Catholic. Now, this is controversial. It can never be proven. I'm not sure we can come up with a written document in which he said, yes, I really was a Catholic, and I sign it here and date it. We're not going to have that. But there are certain things that we can know. Why is this important? Well, simply this, that the time in which Hamlet was written was a time of profound religious tension and open religious warfare. It began, of course, when Henry VIII broke with Rome. It then continued on through the reign of Mary Tudor, who returned the country to the Catholic faith all too briefly. It continued into the reign of Elizabeth, who returned again, broke with Rome again, and returned to that church that her father had set up, that she then claimed to be the head of. And in the midst of it, in the midst of all of this, Catholic martyrs were being made. I'll mention this again, but it was during Shakespeare's lifetime that the great St. Edmund Campion was martyred. If you do not know Evelyn Waugh's account of the life of Campion, read it at once. I'll come back to that. Point being, this is a time of turmoil, a time of tension, and blood is being shed over these very serious questions. What does it have to do with Shakespeare? Well, he was living in that time. He was subject to that queen. And he came from a particular background. Born in 1564, he died in 1616. So his life encompassed that turmoil. What do we know about his background? Born in Stratford, small town, some distance from London. We know that his mother's family, the Arden family, his mother's name being Mary Arden, were Catholic by tradition. They were property, they landowners, they had some money, they were well known in the area around Stratford, and it was a Catholic family. We know certain things about John Shakespeare, Shakespeare's father. Prominent citizen in Stratford, highly respected. He was a glover for a while. He made gloves. But he was so popular and so well respected that he became bailiff of the town for a while, equivalent of the mayor. He served on the council, if you will, of the senior citizens of Stratford until suddenly he was removed. Until suddenly he fell from favor in the town. And it's very clear, although it can't be proven, but there were others who were falling from favor at the same time. They had one thing in common. They were Catholic. And they insisted on maintaining that faith in the face of opposition coming from the official government channels. We also know that John Shakespeare was a recusant. That is, his name appears on lists of those who paid a fine rather than attend the new religious service put forward by the new church. He wouldn't do it. There were many who wouldn't. there were consequences to be suffered, but for the average citizen, the consequence mainly was financial. You had to pay a fine. But lists were kept of who was not attending and who paid the fine. John Shakespeare's name appears on that list. Interestingly enough, later, after the death of William Shakespeare, his daughter's name, Susanna, appears on a similar list. Susanna Shakespeare was also a recusant, paid a fine because she would not attend the new service. The father did, the daughter did, fill in the gap yourself. It seems to me there's a fairly obvious link between Shakespeare's father and Shakespeare's daughter. It's a man named William Shakespeare himself. We know his education came at the Stratford Grammar School. There are those who dismiss this and say, because we do know, that he stopped his education in what's about the equivalent of our eighth grade. And they dismiss him and say Shakespeare had only an eighth grade education. My response to that is, I wish I had had such an education. Ben Jonson makes the slightly derogatory comment in his poem on Shakespeare that Shakespeare had small Latin and less Greek. Well, I have a PhD and I got no Latin and no Greek. The eighth grade at Stratford in the grammar school provided a better training in language than I got with my PhD. And we could extend that. It was a serious, disciplined course of study where those who were at the Stratford Grammar School got a decent and solid education. We also know that the schoolmaster who was there during Shakespeare's time went on to become a very well-known and highly respected figure in education in England. He received some notoriety, therefore he was a very good teacher. And not only did William Shakespeare come out of that class, but one of the most famous lawyers who went on to London, became a very well-known lawyer at the time, came from that same class. Very small class, okay? And two very prominent figures came out of it. We know one other thing about Shakespeare's schoolmaster. He was Catholic. All right? We have another connection. There is speculation, cannot be proven, that for a while he himself worked as a tutor. That he was a smart young man, he'd had some education, and that he went out and did some teaching himself. We're not exactly sure where, but there are some, I won't go into the whole background, but it appears as if he made some associations with a very well-known and prominent family in the north of England. A very well-known Catholic family. There are a couple of critics and commentators who make those links. We have to make reasonable suppositions. They're quite reasonable, but it seems he spent some time with a very prominent Catholic family in the north before he turns up in London. But along the way, he gets married. And what happens in the marriage? Well, it's a shotgun wedding. He wasn't perfect. His wife was 8 years older. And we know that a child was born to her just a few months after the wedding. Okay? Shotgun wedding, they jumped the gun, but they were married. The banns were read, but the banns were only read once in order to hurry the process along. But another little curiosity, even though she also came from a family near Stratford, and Shakespeare came from a family in Stratford, they were not married in Stratford. The marriage took place a little distance away, in a very small village, where they would have had to travel a bit in order to reach this village. Now, there was, of course, a measure of shame in what they had done, but it was not uncommon. And the important thing was that they were indeed getting married. So we cannot say that it was shame that made them run off and hide. That wouldn't have happened. It was fairly common. It happened. And they were doing the right thing in tying the knot and getting married before the child was born. If we look at this tiny little village where they were finally married, we discover that there was a very well-known old man there, who had a reputation throughout that entire area of England, and he was an old, old Catholic priest who had clung to the faith and therefore became something of an outcast, but was so well known and so beloved that he was sort of left alone, and he was allowed to go to this tiny, tiny little village where he was also very well known because he was a healer of birds. If your falcon got hurt, and falcons were used in hunting, okay, if you had a problem with one of your birds, you could take it to this old priest, and he was apparently very successful in healing birds. That was part of his reputation, as well as his holiness. The two may well have been connected. This was a special grace he was given. But the point is made, it is there that Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway were married. Why? I suspect because of the presence of that man. And again, rational guess, it was probably that old priest who married them in private, Catholic wedding. We can't prove it. We don't have the document to show. All we know is that that was the location. He goes to London. He becomes involved in the theater. What do we know? We know that many of the prominent families that he became involved with were Catholic. Many of his closest friends were Catholic. Now, it can of course be said he was a member of the Lord Chamberlain's men, the acting company that worked for the Queen. He was a loyal subject of the Queen. We have that contradiction there. But many of his associations, even within the acting company, were Catholic. And they were close friends. His close friends back in Stratford, Catholic. And then finally, one last bit of information that's come to light just recently, and that is when he left Stratford, the time of his retirement in 1612, during the last few years, he was very successful, he was very prominent, he had done very well financially. He was buying property in Stratford for his retirement. He bought land, he built a new home. But curiously, as he was buying all this property and land in Stratford, he buys one building in London. And it was a puzzlement for a while until a British historian went and traced that deed. He left the building to a friend in London who kept it for a while and passed it to someone else. And when the building was torn down, it was discovered it had been a mass center, a place where priests who had come in secret from the continent could say mass in private, in hiding, for Catholics who who would hide in this building and then go out again, because it was forbidden. Shakespeare bought the building, passed it to a Catholic friend, and it was handed down. Finally, we have the bit of evidence from a letter written by a Protestant minister who was living in Stratford at the time of Shakespeare's death, who writes to another Protestant friend in disgust, "Master Shakespeare died a papist." There's no reason to assume he was lying or making it up, and it suggests that it was known in Stratford at the time of Shakespeare's death that there was a priest and he received the last rites. Here's my own little private theory. This is just Doc White's crackpot theory. There is the curse on the grave in the church in Stratford. "Good friend, for Jesus' sake, forbear to dig the dust, enclose it here. Blessed be the man who spares these stones, but cursed be he who moves my bones." It's a wonderful little four-line poem. The grave has never been opened. My speculation is that the little curse was put on the grave to ensure no one would attempt to dig up the corpse, and my guess is Shakespeare was buried with some sort of clear Catholic relics with him, perhaps a rosary, a scapular, some sort of medal, and that word going around the village, someone might have tried to go in there and dig it up and prove this and discredit his family who were still alive. And in order to prevent that, he himself put a curse on the tomb so it would never be opened. It would just remain sealed. And no one has opened it. Only one crazy American woman tried in the 19th century. That's another story I won't get into now. Ask me later. The best evidence, the plays. The plays are thoroughly Catholic. The plays are so thoroughly Catholic that, again, we know a troupe of Catholic players that couldn't play in London, of course, and therefore toured about England, going from village to village, had as their two most popular plays King Lear and Pericles. The fact that a group of Catholic players would choose two of Shakespeare's plays to perform as sort of their central repertory suggests these Catholic players knew there was something Catholic in those plays. And as a result, those were the two plays that they performed most frequently. My point is this. We can at least posit, let's make modest claims, that Shakespeare had many Catholic connections among family and friends, clearly had Catholic influences on him, and must have had some kind of Catholic sympathy, at least. That, I think we can go that far. And even that becomes important in a time of religious tension and turmoil. He was clearly not a courageous man. He was not a saint or a martyr in his own right. He was a playwright. He was doing different work. And it's clear he was not one of those men. There are some writers of the period who took very strong and public stances about what they believed. Shakespeare didn't do that, but I would make a little claim here that if you look through the movement in the shape of his career, there might even be a reason for that. And some of us know, to our shame, that it's entirely possible to grow up, go on in life, and not take religion at all seriously for very many years. The fact of the matter is, you had a very bright young man who went to London and began to become extremely successful and suddenly was traveling in the best crowd, making good money, in the theater, being a fairly prominent and respected poet as well. He published the two long poems, the narrative poems that he wrote in 1593, 1594, early in his career, highly praised. He was running with the big boys. He was making some money. He was in the big city. You don't have to go far to realize what that would do to a young man, and particularly a young man with an ambitious personality. He was successful. And as a result, we get those golden comedies which say, Life is good. Now, they say it with some complexity. They say it with genuine depth. But the fact of the matter is, that whole first period of his career, the great plays, the most wonderful plays, are those comedies. Life is good. Until suddenly things begin to darken. We can't say precisely what caused the darkening. There may have been private things. He was long separated from his family. We didn't get into the Dark Lady sonnets yesterday, but it's very clear. There's no mistaking the fact that sonnets 127 to 152 make very clear that Shakespeare had an adulterous affair. He writes about it. He was haunted by it. He knew it was wrong. He knew it was sinful. But he felt trapped to a degree in terms of what was going on. But we also know there seems to be a moment when he finally broke free of that relationship. I said that Shakespeare in Love is scandalous. I think it is scandalous. It's clear that he had this one relationship, and it disturbed him greatly. This is, and the poetry makes that clear, this was not a man who would simply be hopping from bed to bed blithely, not caring about what he was doing. We know he sinned. We know the nature of that sin. He wrote about it. He knew it was wrong. He was haunted by it. At some point, it's clear he broke free of that, managed to overcome that. But we know that his own attitude and clearly his view of himself darkened. We also know in 1596, one of his children, his only son, died, drowned. The child's name, Hamnet, H-A-M-N-E-T, Hamnet, okay? Named for a Catholic friend in Stratford. That cannot help but bring a new seriousness to a man, to lose a child. There were also larger political questions. Blood was being spilled over matters of faith. There was a real question about the succession. Elizabeth may or may not have been the virgin queen, but it's very clear she had no offspring. And she refused to name a successor. And she was growing old, and there was a very real fear of what was going to happen upon the death of Elizabeth. So that we come to the latter years of the 1590s, and in the political world, clouds are forming. And also public taste in the playhouse is changing. The plays are becoming darker. Reason for it? Change in taste? Politics? What's happening in the world? We don't know. But it did change. And he also was a very, very clever writer, giving his audiences what he knew they wanted, because that's how you make money. And the plays become darker in nature, become more tragic. It's a whole, we can't point to one thing, but there's a host of things that suggest a movement away from comedy toward tragedy. He had written the early tragedy, Romeo and Juliet, and it is comic in structure. I won't go into that. I've never done Romeo and Juliet here. I should do it sometime. We have the great English history plays that have some that are tragic in structure, Richard III, Richard II. But again, these are early experiments. Richard III modeled on Christopher Marlowe, Richard II, fascinating play, but in its way as interesting for what Shakespeare is discovering about his ability to use poetry to analyze character, to depict character. As for its tragic structure. But in 1599, and we know that we have the year for certain because it was one of the first plays staged in the new Globe Playhouse, Shakespeare writes Julius Caesar, which is an attempt at tragedy. It is also a problem play. I was speaking to some of you about this yesterday. It's called The Tragedy of Julius Caesar. The real tragic hero is Brutus. In some ways, the most interesting figure is Cassius, and Mark Antony can steal any given performance. You have a divided play with about four potential heroes. It's not entirely successful, but it's clear that the playwright's attitude and interest have moved toward tragedy. He's working on it. The simple fact of the matter is Hamlet is a problem play. There's no getting around it. It's just this vast pot of problems, one after another after another, which is why one can endlessly speculate about it. But it was also, from its inception until the modern day, the most popular play that Shakespeare ever wrote. It is the quintessential Shakespeare play. It's the one that everybody knows. It's the one that has more famous lines than any other of the plays. There's a wonderful story of the two little old ladies coming out of a matinee of Hamlet, and the one turning to the other and saying, "My, I didn't know that play was so filled with quotations." That's Hamlet. I mean, just every other line has entered the language. It's just, you know, this play has supplied us with things, phrases and ideas and images we just use all the time. It's entered, it's become part of our world and our structure. Now, it was hugely popular. And we know for a fact it was part of a tradition. He was entering into something of a tradition. I just want to say a couple of words about this because I think it is important in terms of the tradition it's coming out of, because it complicates what he's doing in the play. Revenge plays had been popular during the 1580s and the 1590s. They had been around. The most famous writer of revenge plays was a playwright named Thomas Kyd. Highly honored, and he had written what was the most popular play in the English theater, really, until Shakespeare's time. That is the Spanish Tragedy, it was called. Hugely popular. And it's a father who loses his son. The ghost of the son comes back and says, "I was murdered." The father goes for revenge. The father goes mad. The father is slaughtering everybody, and they finally catch him and demand that he confess. And in order to prevent himself from confessing, he bites his own tongue out. It's a very exciting play. This tradition of the bloody revenge play that turns into the glories of English tragedy, it gets picked up on by both Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare, comes from the classical world again, but not from the Greeks. The Greek tragedians were just beginning to be read at the time that Shakespeare was writing. The tragedians that the English theater of Shakespeare's day knew were the Roman writers. I mentioned Seneca earlier in my talk on Sophocles, talking about his Phaedra, where the body of Hippolytus is brought into his father Theseus, who tries to put the body back together like a jigsaw puzzle because it's been ripped apart. That is Senecan tragedy. That is Roman tragedy. It is gaudy. It is bloody. It is highly rhetorical rather than poetic. But that was the tradition that the English playwrights knew, and that was the tradition they were working out of. It was not Greek, where violence was obscene. Violence should take place off stage, away from the scene, should not be viewed by the audience. Not for the Romans. The Romans had a taste for blood, and Seneca gave it to them. And blood was spilled all over the stage. When Shakespeare writes his very first tragedy, and a real embarrassment called Titus Andronicus, although it's a blood and thunder stage piece that can still work, there is blood from beginning to end. The heroine has her tongue ripped out and her hands chopped off. The title character chops off his own hand at one point. It ends with the evil queen being served her own children baked up in a pie. It is gruesome, absolutely gruesome. There is horror and murder and blinding and torture. There was a production done at the first season at the American Players Theater in southern Wisconsin. And at the intermission, they had to bring out a stage crew to mop up the stage blood. It was sort of, it's intermission, let's clean up the blood off the stage floor. That is the Senecan Roman tragic tradition out of which the English theater emerged. Okay? And Shakespeare was part of it. He uses it. he uses it with some genuine artistic care, okay? He outgrows Titus Andronicus. He will use it sparingly, but it will still happen. Witness, for example, the blinding of Gloucester in King Lear. When he, on stage, when he needs a moment like that, he will use it, okay? And he, that's because he learned his lesson well, and he learned it from Seneca. And that is part of Roman tragedy. These plays were exceedingly popular. It is believed that Thomas Kyd wrote an earlier version of Hamlet. The Hamlet story was around. Everybody knew it. It's apparently based on some kind of historical, actual historical event. There is a writer from the 12th century, Saxo Grammaticus, who wrote a history of Denmark and talks about young Prince Amleth and gives some details of the story. The story became very popular in the 16th century because of a French writer named Belfore, who in his Histoire Tragique tells the story. And that little volume of tragic stories went through 8 editions in about 20 years. Everybody was buying it. It was hugely popular. So the story was known. And there were apparently earlier stage versions, including one very popular one that we don't have the manuscript for. We only know of it secondhand because others talk about it. And it is clear that there had been a popular Hamlet play on the stage at some point in the 1580s or early 1590s. So what Shakespeare was doing was tapping into a popular tradition and grabbing a hold of a very popular story and giving his own version of it. We can't imagine that today because of copyright laws. But imagine, if you would, that the announcement was made in the paper that Francis Ford Coppola was going to do his own Star Wars trilogy. Okay? And all of a sudden we have you love the Lucas? Come see the Francis Ford Coppola. Would people line up at the box office? In droves, like crazy. Of course they would. That's what's happening with the Hamlet story. Very popular story. And now, one of your favorite playwrights is doing his version of it. Wow! Okay? It had all the earmarks of a surefire hit. It was bound to be successful. And as I said yesterday, it was Shakespeare's most successful play. Reason it's the longest play of all the plays, because it kept being revived and revived, and when they would revive it season after season, he would add new material. Now, he was an artist. He wouldn't just stick it in. He kept reshaping, and the play kept growing, and that's why it's the longest play, okay? When you did the revival, you had to give the audience something a little bit new so they'd want to come in. So you'd put a new scene here, another speech there, and they'd get a little something new as well as the old play that they loved. And it just got bigger and bigger, okay? I must say a word on behalf of popular art. There is nothing wrong with works that are popular. In our own time, the intellectuals look down on them. Let me just talk briefly about that tradition. I've mentioned it earlier. When Sophocles wrote Oedipus Rex, he wanted to win first prize. He wanted to write a play that was so good, that would be so well beloved by that audience, that he would win first prize in the dramatic competition. And it was hugely popular. When Shakespeare wrote Hamlet, he was writing popular entertainment. Everybody in London lined up to see it. So that we have there not something highly literary and intellectual, we have popular entertainment. When Verdi was writing his operas in Italy, he knew when he made the contract to write an opera for the opening of the Suez Canal called Aida, he had a great opportunity, and he gave the opening rights to Egypt, but he himself retained the rights in Italy and throughout the rest of the world. Why? Big bucks. And sure enough, Aida remains the most popular opera ever done at the Metropolitan Opera and most other opera houses. Hugely, hugely popular. And Verdi himself said, if you want to know how successful your work is, look at the box office receipts. Okay? Which is a rather crude variation of Dr. Samuel Johnson's famous couplet, the theater's laws the theater's patrons give. For we who live to please must please to live. It's a wonderful little couplet. This is something that's largely forgotten now, but I would say we've had a taste of it in our own time. When I was 8 years old and going to those movies on Saturday afternoon, I'd go with my friends to the movies. Sunday afternoon, I'd go with my parents to the movies. That was the tradition. And just, you know, all the popcorn and milk duds you could eat. It was a great time. But the things I loved most and the things that were most successful and things that everybody waited for was the new John Wayne Western, okay? And I remember being 8 years old when the Searchers first came out. And going to see it on the big screen. It's considered one of the great American films, one of the great works of art. But when I was 8 years old, I didn't know that. I just knew there was a new John Wayne Western. I didn't know who John Ford, the director, was. I didn't know he was a great artist. I had no idea he had established the myth of the West and all of that. I didn't know he had created John Wayne. I knew none of that. I just knew, ooh, it's going to be a good movie. Maybe I'll buy a box of jujubes as well as some milk duds, okay? And it was, I went because, and when the new Hitchcock film came to town, oh, you couldn't wait for that because you knew that was going to be good, and everybody went. The kids could get in, the grown-ups would go, that was a time when everybody went to the movies because the movies were popular entertainment. And being popular did not preclude art. And Alfred Hitchcock and John Ford are two of the greatest artists that America has ever produced. There is nothing wrong with popular art. Hamlet is Shakespeare's most popular play. We know it was written sometime in the very late 1599, very end of 1599, the latest possible date, early 1602. It probably sometime 1600, 1601. For simplicity's sake, I always tell my students, Hamlet, 1600. Okay? Very easy to remember. Hamlet, 1600. And in that way, you can have some sense, some placement in terms of where this play comes. But we also have in that a clear dividing line then between what I call the old world and the new world. And I'm going to make the claim as I go through and as we look at the play that Hamlet is the first modern work of art. The modern world is born in Hamlet. That's where the modern world begins. I was going to do some other background. I want to get into the play. I'm going to fall behind, I know it. So let me begin with the play. And let me do that by expanding on that connection. Hamlet is modern. What do I mean by that? Well, before we get into the play, I want to make two points of events that happen outside the play. We talked about some of it in terms of plot and certain things we need to know in terms of the narrative. Very important, and I'll come back to those later, about the battles between Denmark and Norway and Poland, because all of that is very important in terms of our understanding of the play. But I want to begin with something that's a little bit different. This also is something from outside the play that is given to us. I'm in Act 2. Scene 2. I'm at about line 115 for those of you that have line numbers. For the rest of you who have the Dover edition, I am on page 37, top of page 37 in this edition, okay? So, page 37 in the Dover or Act 2, Scene 2, line, I've got about 115 here. It is the little letter that Hamlet has written to Ophelia. Remember the moment Polonius comes into the king and queen and says, I've discovered Hamlet's problem. I figured it out. I know what the problem is. He's in love with my daughter, and I told her she couldn't see him anymore. That's the problem. But in order to prove the point, Polonius pulls out a letter that Hamlet has written to Ophelia. Now, it is possible that he may have given a note to her after he's come back to the court to attend his father's funeral. But it seems to me unlikely. Insofar as we know, once he gets back for his father's funeral and discovers his mother is married, that becomes a preoccupation. And when he does see Ophelia, and we get the little scene given to us by Zeffirelli, he's speechless. He just makes that appearance. We learn about it secondhand in the play. He's there in her chamber and then looks strange and disappears. We don't have the sense there's been a lot of contact with him while he's been back, and he hasn't been back that long, which means if Polonius pulls out a letter, it was probably written from school. Wittenberg. Not accidental that Hamlet has been studying at the University of Wittenberg, the city where Luther nailed his theses to the church door. It is in Wittenberg that the great schism first takes place, where the authority of the church is denied, where Luther begins, in a very real sense, that modern mess that we're still trapped in. There are only two characters in Elizabethan drama who study at Wittenberg. One is Hamlet, and the other is Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. And this isn't accidental. Marlowe claimed to be an atheist, but boy, no real atheist could have written Dr. Faustus. And the fact that Faustus is at Wittenberg isn't accidental, nor is it accidental that the devil shows up there and is in Faustus's study, okay? All of that's important. Any audience at that time hearing the word Wittenberg would have had red flags go up, and the red flags would have had to do with religious problems, religious questions. Look at the letter that Hamlet writes to Ophelia. And I'm going to make the claim from Wittenberg. I think that's a sensible claim that can be made. To the celestial and my soul's idol. She is heavenly, she is the idol of Hamlet's soul. Well, that's a heavy burden. Those are strong words. Okay, that's a lot for a young woman to bear. We're going to see how it crushes her. The most beautified Ophelia. That's an ill phrase, a vile phrase. Beautified is a vile phrase, but you shall hear. I love it. Polonius is a critic, even as he reads Hamlet's letter. These in her excellent white bosom, these, etc., etc. And then we get the gist of the letter. Doubt thou the stars are fire. Doubt that the sun doth move. Doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love. O dear Ophelia, I am ill at these numbers. I'm not a good poet. I have not art to reckon my groans. He's deeply upset. But he's not upset by his love for her. That's the one thing he doesn't doubt. That's the last line of the little poem. What's he groaning about? Well, you could make the case that he did write it after he got back, but that's not what the poem is talking about. The groans suggest groans of doubt. He's been studying at Wittenberg. Something has happened to the whole universe. Doubt that the stars are fire. We don't even know. I mean, they'd always been told that's what the stars were. Well, we don't know anymore. Doubt that the sun doth move. The entire makeup of the celestial sphere had come under doubt, been restructured. Doubt truth to be a liar. All those things that were told you to be true and all those sources of authority that assured you they were true, all lies. From Wittenberg, it's a modern university. Doubt, 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 doubt. Don't believe anything. The only thing you can do is doubt. I have not art to reckon my groans, but that I love thee best, O most best, believe it, adieu. Thine evermore, most dear lady, whilst this machine is to him. And please notice, we're already entering that world where nature is just a mechanism. The thought of Hamlet referring to himself as a machine is belittling. He's much more than that. There's one thing he's not. He's a machine. He is a complex human being who thinks and loves and jokes and is witty and, you know, he's not a machine. But why does he use the phrase? Because this, again, he probably was taught it at Wittenberg. The universe is a big mechanism, and now we're going to get that later officially from science. It's just, the whole thing is a big clock. And God is the clockmaker who just sets it in motion and then sits back. But there is a hint of that coming in already, and it's almost an inevitability if you come to doubt everything. Well, there seems to be some order up there. Well, yes, there's order, but it's just the order of a clock. The point I am making, before we get into the play, look what has happened to our hero. Something significant has happened to his view from his university education. It happened to many of us when we went off to the university, except mine was called Minnesota, not Wittenberg. But what had happened by that point is that what was taught at Wittenberg had spread worldwide and now infected every university. And what is it? Doubt everything. Doubt everything. Doubt truth to be a liar. You can't even know what's true and what's false anymore, so just doubt everything. This is going to have its effect before the play begins. And before the play begins, and this is hugely important, if Hamlet has anything to hold on to, if Hamlet has anything to believe in, this little poem makes clear what it is. He's not yet doubting love. Particularly, his love for Ophelia. That's what he's holding on to. That's what he believes in. There may be no meaning in anything. We may not be able to know anything. We may have to doubt everything, but never doubt I love. There is a reason why, you see it right here, Hamlet, the play, was rediscovered by the Romantics. When the theaters were closed, 1642, and then reopened in 1660 after the Puritan Revolution, a whole new kind of play went on the stage. We had a whole new British theater. And from the late 17th century through the 18th century, Shakespeare was very popular. But the popular plays were Richard III, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, The Tempest, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Hamlet wasn't particularly popular. Why? Because it was a reasonable social age. Okay? This was a little too much for them. They didn't care for big problem plays. But when the Romantics came along, whoa! They rediscovered Hamlet, and this is the reason why. Because ideas had failed, and what are we left with? Never doubt I love. Human passion is there. The anti-hero, the heroic anti-hero is there. And Hamlet became the romantic hero. And the play knew the same kind of popularity again that it had known in Shakespeare's day. And it's very clear why. Hamlet begins the play as a kind of romantic who's come to doubt everything, who's questioned everything, but still has love to hold on to. Okay? Keep that in mind. I'm going to come back to it when we look at, Act 1, Scene 2. I've got a little time. Let me do Act 1, Scene 1. I can actually do Act 1, Scene 1 here. I've got a few minutes before we take our break. We mentioned yesterday, play begins on the ramparts of the castle. Mentioned yesterday, this play is trapped in Elsinore. This play is trapped at the castle. It is probably, in terms of scenes, more bound in than any other play Shakespeare wrote. There are only the two occasions we really get outside the castle, and that is when we're out on the open plain and Fortinbras's army marches by, and when we get outside to the graveyard. The rest of the time, we're either on the battlements of the castle or we're inside the castle, exclusively. So we're bound there. But something interesting happens here. Okay, we've got the sentinels. We've got the sentinels. There are preparations for war. That's why they've been put up there. Everybody's a bit nervous. We're not sure if war is coming or not. And, you know, and as if that's not enough, now there's this ghost walking around the battlements. Well, you know, it makes one even more unnerved. Now, of course, we don't know that heading in. But notice, this is the sort of thing. Notice the very opening lines. I just love this. First line of the play goes to Barnardo. The opening line of this problem play, of course, is a question. Who's there? And instead of a response, notice the answer from Francisco, the other sentinel. Nay, answer me. You've got the first of the problems right there. Sort this out. And I simply, don't look at your text now. Tell me who's on watch and who's relieving whom. No idea. We can't tell what's happening. We have somebody who's seen a figure and yells out, tell me who you are. And the other figure yells out, no, I'm not. You tell me. Stand and unfold yourself. Don't move. You tell me who you are. And we're at, in the first two lines, the principal theme of the whole play. Who are you? Who are you? Who are you? And how can I know? And in fact, we could come down to the Hamlet problem in one question, which is, who's there? Who is this guy? What's he like? This is the genius. You got the whole play in the first two lines. There it is. Okay? I haven't said this yet, I'll say it now. In case you hadn't noticed, there is a theme to all of the works we're looking at. Every one of them. Oedipus is the great play about self-knowledge. What does Oedipus ask? Who am I? What's Hamlet about? We ask, who's Hamlet? The Scarlet Letter? Woo. Who is Arthur Dimmesdale and what has he done? Notes from Underground, who is this man talking to us? Okay. The Moviegoer, Binks Bowling, finding out who he is. And the wonderful Flannery O'Connor short story, okay? Mrs. Turpin being forced to find out who she is, okay? These are all works about self-knowledge and how we can know the self. And it's right here in the opening lines of Hamlet. Who's there? Nay, answer me, stand and unfold yourself. Long live the king. And then we get Bernardo, he. Finally, there's an identification. You come most carefully upon your hour. Okay. You've come to relieve me, haven't you? But boy, You're doing it very carefully. You're right on time, but it's sort of, why'd you sneak up on me? 'Tis now struck 12. Get thee to bed, Francisco. And suddenly we realize the guy being relieved is not the one who yelled, who's there? It wasn't the one on guard who yelled, who's there? It's the relief who's just showing up who yelled, who's there? It's a wonderful little opening. It goes by so quickly in the theater you don't even know it's happened. But you better believe Shakespeare's chuckling as he writes the first five lines of this play. Because we already have some sort of inverted order. The order is already inverted. Who's there is being asked by the relief, not by the one on guard. And trying to sort out who is on guard and which one is who and why, because they're both afraid the other one's a ghost. But we don't know that yet. Which means, as the play begins, we don't know what's going on. They don't seem to know what's going on. What's going on? For this relief, much thanks, says Francisco. Boy, I'm glad you came. 'Tis bitter cold, and I am sick at heart. This is not your average. I mean, I'll tell you, they stand watch at the Naval Academy. And when the replacement stands up, It's, boy, I'm glad you're here because I'm tired, I'm going to bed. Or if they're outside on watch, it is indeed, oh yeah, it is cold. Good luck to you, I'm going inside and getting warm. That is absolutely standard. For this relief, much thanks, 'tis bitter cold. And I am sick at heart is not standard. There's something more going on here when the very soldiers on the ramparts of the castle are complaining about melancholia and depression. We're already being set up for that statement that's going to come later that, you know, something's rotten in the state of Denmark. But before it becomes a public sickness and rottenness, there is a problem in the heart of the very soldiers who are guarding the castle. And I am sick at heart. Have you had quiet guard? Not a mouse stirring. Nothing happened. Well, then what are you so upset about? Well, it's wonderful. Then what's all this fuss about? Not a mouse stirring. Well, good night. Okay? If you do meet Horatio and Marcellus, the rivals of my watch, bid them make haste. Okay? We've got other men. We've got other guards on the ramparts. We've got a lot of guys walking the ramparts. It's wonderful. And this in and of itself is instructive. I think I hear them. Stand, oh, who is there? And this time, you'll notice, it is indeed the man who's taken over the watch, who now indeed says that, friends to this ground and liegemen to the Dane, give you good night. Oh, farewell, honest soldier. Who hath relieved you? Barnardo hath my place. Give you good night, okay? It's all prologue to the ghost. If I was teaching playwriting 101 now, what we would be talking about is you have to grab the audience's attention in the first scene. You have to come up with something atmospheric and catchy that will draw them into the play. Well, it's going on here, and it's wonderful. And to top it off, of course, we get the ghost. We get the exchange with the ghost. And of course, one voice has said, ah, nonsense, no, no, no. There's no such thing as a ghost. Who is it? It's Horatio. Who is Horatio? Hamlet's friend from school. Meaning, where has Horatio been studying? At Wittenberg. What's the result of Horatio's studies at Wittenberg? He doubts in ghosts. He doesn't believe there's such a thing as ghosts. You go to study at the university and what do you... Ah, there are no ghosts. Ghosts, there's no supernatural. Forget it. Forget it. Those famous lines that will come at the end of Act 1 are being set up here. Horatio is the Stoic. At the end of the play, he's going to say, okay, I am more antique Roman than Dane. Okay, and he's going to make that claim. We're going to look at that one some days from now when we get to the end of the play. But he makes the claim, I'm a Roman, I'm a Stoic, things don't touch me. But the fact of the matter, here, indeed he's saying, no, I'm a rationalist, I'm a Stoic, there are no ghosts. He's gotten a good university education at Wittenberg. He doubts ghosts. When Hamlet speaks with the ghost, he will then say those famous words, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And that philosophy is Stoicism, is naturalistic. The gods don't exist, there's no supernatural, we're just here, and therefore, with as much discipline and order, we move through the world untouched. And it is not accidental that at that moment at the end, Horatio reaches out for the poison cup to commit suicide. That's what a good Stoic does. And then you come to the point where, okay, that's enough. I can't take it anymore. Now I dispense myself. There is consistency throughout the play in terms of Horatio's character. Point I'm making here, Horatio studied at Wittenberg. Okay?